to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. We're at a point in the narrative, we're on page 142 here, where Rigpa Master goes into considerable detail on a past life memory, and she connects it up in a really thorough and very deep way with her kind of general koan and other past lives. And I don't think I'm going to be able to go through, read this word for word, but I'll give a little gist of the kind of first page. She experiences on the 31st of December, which is, you know, she was born on January 1st, so it's the day before her birthday. It's kind of nice. The last day of 76, anyway, she experiences a memory of a past life of a Tartar who was who indulged in a kind of game in which they ran at each other with horses and slashed it at the horse's leg to try to bring each other down. A ghastly thing to do. People do ghastly things. And they had a lot of horses, you know. Anyway, he gets himself, comes down and a horse lands on him, and he's dying and sinking in a bog to boot, and the people don't help him. And one of the people who's his best friend comes over and watches him die, basically, without trying to help. Maybe that's in their culture. Maybe that's how they did things. At any rate, as he's dying, he sees a Buddhist monk who's present. Just glimpses him from the corner of his eye. And he has the thought, you know, that's what I should have been doing. And this sets up the next life, which is a monk life, where the person cleans up the karma of that individual. And I've just covered about a page. So now I'll cut in here. Rim Master says, if this Tartar had meditated, he could have ascended the third column and enjoyed the world with a peaceful heart. He would have known from whence help came in time of affliction. He would have needed no external excitement to combat his boredom, for he would forever have been fulfilled from within. And through the use of the fifth column, he could have united heaven and earth for all to see. Heaven and earth, help and need, remember? All is one and the all is different. They're all one within the fifth column of the eternal, really. I mean, all the columns together are the eternal. But all the columns, the oneness of all the columns is the fifth column. The oneness of all things. The eternal is all of it. That's like the fifth noble, of the four noble truths, that's the fifth. The Buddha nature is the fifth noble truth. He says, this man was a great jouster, but all he had to show as his life's work was skill in killing horses and the aches, pains, bruises, and deaths of his fellow contestants. Small wonder he died wishing to be a monk when the Lord asked the inevitable question, what is your purpose for living? How could he say to the Lord, my purpose is to knock others off horses by killing the horses? Good point. What about the poor horses, too? The greatest prayer I know is, Lord, give me the time and the knowledge to make the right decisions concerning my life before I meet you face to face. Because at the time of death, we're all presented by the pure, we're all presented with or met by time of death and offered the opportunity for full reunion with the Eternal. And many times people say, no, I'm not worthy. No, I want something else. And no, I'm too afraid of being judged. Whereas the Eternal Course does not judge. We just project our judgment of ourselves onto others, onto God, onto the Eternal. And I agree completely that this is the greatest prayer there is. The greatest prayer is that I may reharmonize with the Eternal in this life so that at the time of my death I may not be confused about what it is I am meeting face to face and what my purpose for living is at that time. Because you take your purpose for living right into death. And if your purpose for living is to follow the Eternal, then in death that will be your purpose too. To follow the Eternal. Wherever the Eternal leads. She goes on to say that this Tartar's koan, spiritual problem, was the same as that of the white tiger and of the woman of whom I spoke earlier. And this is what happens. The connections get made. Plunkety, 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 plunk. Connection, 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 connection. Oh, this is the same basic thing. So what is it that is the same amongst these three? She says, all three wanted freedom to be truly themselves. And of the three, only the tiger knew who and what he was at the time of his capture. A tiger. The simplicity of the animal mind as opposed to the more convoluted delusion of human beings. She says, how sad that man confused his mind at the time of death. It's sad, and yet at the same time, it made possible us having Reverend Master and her teaching in a certain way. Remember what I said yesterday about the, what was it, GPS? The GPS, is that what it is? Little machine that recalculates instantly. You know, remember the recalculating. The Eternal turns all things to good. Without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails. Without fail, the process of conversion eventually prevails. She goes on to say the Tartar tried to escape the mundaneness of ordinary life by doing daring acts, but that didn't give true freedom. It's just more external things. It's not true freedom. And the tiger got confused and thought that he could only have freedom by getting out of the cage. Whereas the true freedom is found within the heart, not in externals. Then she says, down the centuries there have been many, many monks who were in that stream of karma that has now come down to me. All tried to penetrate the truth, some by meditation, others by prayer. All were true seekers of the way, whether Christian or Buddhist. Many were content with heaven and some with the lake of quietism. In other words, some got stuck at certain points along the way. These were good people, but fearing the loss of the little freedom they had gained, they went into hardness and coldness and lovelessness through ascetic practices, and so doing lost their little freedom, lost what little freedom they had found. That so often is the case in religion. The really serious people will start pushing too hard. And it's greatly encouraged in some forms of Buddhism and some forms of Christianity and in some forms of all religions, really. It's greatly encouraged. You remember that's where the Buddha got, you know, nearly killed himself doing ascetic practices and was a kind of master of ascetic practices and was just killing himself and getting nowhere else, basically. So he had to find the true way, which is the middle path. The path of taking care of the body, respecting the body, not viewing it as the obstacle, but viewing it as the vehicle. A vehicle to be loved and treasured and taken good care of. At the same time, not just wandering off into sense indulgence and wasting time and going splat in worldliness. So there's a middle path, the path of true meditation and true training. She goes on to say, one of these monks, the organist of a Christian monastery, and her master, you know, became an organist, and she's a great organist. I heard her play, you know, a little bit. She's great. And a fine composer as well. She says, one of them, the organist of a Christian monastery, tried to find freedom by burying himself completely in his music, but freedom was not to be found therein. One is tempted to say that this is a step up from killing horses and flogging oneself. Ascetic flogging, she's referring to. But music and learning are just as much impediments to finding true freedom as are horse killing and flogging, and considerably more subtle. That is, they look more spiritual. With luck, one gets sick of killing and flogging in time, as did my inherited karmic stream. However, music and learning can compound delusions hugely. And then came the woman. Remember the Slavic woman who got involved in a freedom movement? She did not enter religion. She tried to find freedom externally by helping political activists. To do what? To gain freedom. Always the search for freedom, see? That's what she's seeing here. The monks had tried to storm heaven and had failed. She would snatch freedom, both for herself and others. No wonder her dying thoughts were, what did I do wrong? I was helping people become free. I've so often said, true spirituality goes beyond the worldly ideas of doing good. Just making good karma is not the purpose of contemplative spirituality. She says, she took the opposite road to asceticism and ended up in the same place as the ascetics, confused. And all any of them had to do was ask the Lord for help in the right way. And still people ask the opinions of others and read books instead of themselves asking the Lord of the house directly and being willing to give all in return for the opening of the treasure house. This is where I could quote Reverend Master Mokshin on the difference between just asking others' opinions and taking refuge in the Sangha, but I think she may be giving some teaching on that herself soon, and I welcome it, because there is a difference. Just going around canvassing others for opinions is not the same as taking refuge in the Sangha. Nothing removes our essential spiritual responsibility to look to our own heart for guidance. And there are those who can help us do that. The Sangha refuge. You see? That doesn't mean it's not sometimes good to ask the opinions of others. When it is good, when one is led by the heart to do so. And sometimes that is not good. And one, I'll just mention something that happened to me, that at one point I was seriously doubting whether I should stay up here or move back to the Abbey after I'd moved up here. And I took it to Room Master, and Room Master asked all the seniors to meditate on it and give their point of view. And basically all the seniors but one said, well, it would be fine for them if I moved back to the Abbey. And that one senior and another senior said, well, I think you should actually go up and stay up there. And then I went back to Room Master and I told her that. And Room Master was sitting in her office, sitting with her kind of arms on her legs the way she would at times, and she was really meditating on something, sitting in her chair, you know, with her sitting forward and upright, with her kind of her hands on her knees, I guess really what it was, kind of just, she'd really been meditating on something. And I came in, I told her, and she said, everything in me says, go back up there. She just said, everything in me says, go back up there. She had canvassed for the opinions. She asked people to meditate on it. She came out with something totally different than everyone but one person. And God, I've been grateful ever since that she did that. Because really in my heart, I was doubting it. And at the same time in my heart, I knew I was just going to die if I couldn't come back up here. I mean, and we got through the doubt there. It's not that I wanted to leave Room Master. That was part of the doubt, you see. But I needed to do this. And as it turned out, others have needed me to do this. Maybe more to the point, I don't know. Room Master goes on to say, this pillar of the universe, this Iron Man, which is really the fifth column, is owned by every single one of us. I would say owns us, but we say we all have the Buddha nature. That's what it means. That's what she's saying here. We are all the children of Buddha. All we have to do is meditate sincerely and without doubt. Then we can look up and see the Buddha at all times, even in the darkest place. That's the first column, looking up, even in the darkest place. And then look down on the turbulence of the world from the third column, thus seeing the turmoil through the eyes of the Lord. When we look with enlightened eyes, we see not a speck of dust. We see the Buddha land wherever we are when we look with enlightened eyes. There were people living in those horrific concentration camps, a few people at least, who lived in those camps and saw the Buddha land there. And were a blessing to everyone around them. We all have the capacity to transcend the opposites and live magnificently from our true nature. She says, safe and secure in this place, true freedom is ours for eternity. Not in an external place, within our heart, within the haven of our own heart. And here is the, in this last sentence, here is the answer to the whole stream of karma, you see. She's showing the longing for freedom, the search for freedom. Here's the person who found it. Safe and secure in this place, true freedom is ours for eternity. Not just mine, but ours. All the karmic stream They're all there together with each of us when we come to that place. She says, it is this from this position in the third column that the Zen master answers questions put to him during Jodo and Shosan, the time when monks come before the master or before the abbot to ask questions in the meditation hall or in the ceremony hall. It's a formal ceremony, a very deep ceremony. We do it here twice a year. In the bigger monasteries, they do it, I believe, as often as twice a month. Sometimes we do it a little more often than that here. She says, the disciple is usually in the first column and the master in the third. The question is washed clean of delusion in the second column so that the master may make his answer the waters of the fountain of the Dharma in the fourth column. And these things are not one, two, three, four steps in a chain, but one straight line, which is the fifth column, directly joining earth and heaven. Earth, the need brought to the master. Heaven, the help coming from the eternal through the master. The need brought through the disciple, the help coming through the master. This one straight line, which is the fifth column, directly joining earth and heaven in luminescent darkness and dark brightness. In the fifth column, dark and light are totally one, as in the Sandokai. Separate in appearance and one in reality. This is amazing, what I've just read here about this, what happens at a Jodo and Shosan. It shows, I'm going to just pause here and explain it in a little more detail, but it shows the incredible saturation, the depth at which your master has understood the teaching that she's given repeatedly now about the columns and about their practical application. It's amazing that she would come out with this, frankly. It's amazing. So let's look at it again. The disciple comes before the master with a question. Think of the master as in the help position, the disciple as in the need position. The question, question in the need position. The potential response in the help, the response waiting in the help position. You bring the question to the situation, you open your heart, you let the question fly out like an arrow towards the help. And then out of the master, out of the abbot, comes the answer, the arrow to meet the arrow of the disciple. The disciple's launching of the arrow of the question comes from the position of looking up within the first column. The position of need looking towards help. That's the first column. In the second column is the place at which the question has been launched towards the answer, towards the help. And from the third column, the help is launched towards the question, and they meet in the second column where the karmic washing happens. And this enables the fourth column to manifest, and we're just about to talk about the fourth column, where the waters of the fountain of the Dharma rain as the Dharma comes down as nectar, giving help and peace where there was a problem, where there was need, where there was trouble and pain. And all of this process is not one, two, three, four separate steps, but one continuity manifesting, one process manifesting within the context of the infinite love and wisdom of the eternal. So, And see, this fifth column, which we're also going to get to, it's so important because it means that all that question is the answer waiting. The question is the potential for the answer to manifest. And all that the answer is the potential for the question to be enlightened. And there is, in the end, no separate question and answer. There's just help and need in this dance, dissolving into oneness, and enlightenment happening. And don't despise the least little bit of enlightenment. We always think, we hear enlightenment, we think it's got to be some big enlightenment. What about just that quiet meditation where you sat down in meditation and you were agitated or worried, and 30 minutes later you got up and you felt peaceful? That's the same thing happening. The same thing happening. You sat down, you looked up, you got still, you went into meditation, first column. Then the need is presented in the meditation, and that's why so often the beginning of meditation at such a time will be painful. And then as you sit there, the pain kind of comes to a peak and then diminishes, and that's where the help of the eternal is meeting the need, and then it goes more peaceful. Then you get up and you're like, I've had many times when I got up, I was just like a different person than the person who sat down on that cushion half hour before. Instead of worrying about, well, you know, why are you such a bad person that you sit down and you're agitated? Forget that. Let's just say, well, thank God there's meditation to help people like me who need help. And over time, the agitation, the trouble of the heart diminishes. It's replaced by greater peace, greater certainty. Again and again, you know, I keep saying this is practical teaching. This isn't something esoteric and remote from our daily experience. She says, thus do master and disciple turn the wheel of the law and thereby show many aspects of the truth. Master and disciple, they're really the same thing in two aspects. That's the truth of the transmission. That's why it's correct to say that master transmits disciple and disciple transmits master. The transmission is master and disciple are relative points within it. That's why I always capitalize the word transmission when I write it. She says, parents are placed in the same position as the master by their children. How sad it is that no parent I have ever met has been secure in this third column. Their children have asked their very real questions in vain and have ended up like their parents with disharmony of body and mind. Their true nature torn from its true home sometimes the rest of their lives. How wondrous is this third column. May I dwell there for eternity if the Lord of the house so wills. Of course, she wrote this in 1976, and she might have said something a little different 20 years later. Because by then, you know, some of her disciples had raised children, and she might have seen a slightly different result. I don't know. Of course, children have their own karma. And it so often is the case that parents, though they love their children like crazy, they're also confused. And so they also pass on their own confusion to some degree or other to their children. She says, as with the other columns, the fourth aspect of this third column is its purpose, the cessation of suffering. And the fifth aspect is its oneness with the other four columns within the fifth column. And then the next talk, we start talking about the fourth column, which is entitled Bathed in the Fountain of the Lord. This is the Buddha, this is the Dharma, this is the Sangha.